It's wonderful to see Bishop Don looking archetypally like an Anglican bishop. I'm almost tempted to say stand up and turn around, but I won't do that. And yet he's called a moderator. I mean, anyone who looks less Presbyterian, I've yet to come across. One day I will know why. Thank you for this drink. May I assure the audience that this is only Coca-Cola without the rum. And I know that some of you, at least those who are here from the Synod, have eaten rather well. Praise the Lord for that. And I have full sympathy with you because you've had a long day, you've had a banquet, so if you doze off, well, that's fine. I would like to myself, actually, having arrived only last night, but I think that might be disastrous for the cause. Thank you very much, all of you, for taking the trouble and coming. And I really want to begin by saying, and this is really quite heartfelt, is that I am tired of being called a conservative. You know. Of course, there is a sense in which we should be conservative, and I'll come to that in a moment. But really, this is about radical discipleship. We want to be people who, in fulfilling the gospel mandate, include those who are shut out. Of course we do. We want to reach out to those who are shut in. We want to minister to those who have learning difficulties. We want to stand alongside the oppressed. So much of my work now, since I have stood down as the Bishop of Rochester, has been with the persecuted church. Many of these brothers and sisters are fellow Anglicans. Not all, but many. And we want to be in solidarity with them. This is a costly work for us, but of course it is nothing like the price that they are paying for their faith and for being disciples. Even where we uphold things like marriage and the family, we do so because of our deep conviction that this is good not only for people, but for society as a whole. Of course, it is true that we need to put our money where our mouth is. I mean, this is not in support of Paul's appeal, by the way. I hope it does get supported. It might pay my fares, who knows. It's not about that. For instance, biblically minded Christians rightly are concerned in so many Western nations about the dignity of human life, about the need to protect it at its very earliest stages. We had a big demonstration and service outside Parliament just last week about the Abortion Act and its unforeseen consequences in Britain. I know you have similar problems here. Of course we should be concerned about that. But then, what do we do about the children who come into this world and who cannot be cared for by their natural parents? I met a wonderfully apostolic woman in Australia who has given her life to caring for children who would otherwise have been aborted. That's gospel ministry. What do we do about those people who are ill or elderly and feel there is nothing more that life has for them? Assisted suicide and voluntary euthanasia. 10 years ago, if you'd taken a poll in Britain, most people would have been against it. But the lobbies have been working very hard. And now, majorities are in favor of it. Of course, the Christian hospice movement has been wonderful in making sure that no one needs suffer pain when they are even very seriously, even terminally ill. But how do churches, how do Christians in churches support such movements. Marriage preparation. A lot of clergy here. Can we all put our hands on our hearts and say, marriage preparation is thorough in our parishes and churches? Because if it's not, then our support of marriage is just words. What about the family? Work with children. It's so good to have the young people sitting so bravely in front. They don't know what's going to be asked of them in a moment. but well done anyway. No, of course, nothing will be asked of you. Don't worry. Of course, we want to be radical in our discipleship because we feel that is what the Lord is calling us to. But if we are to be freed to do this, then we need a right view of the church and of our calling. And that is the subject that I want to address this evening along with you, and I hope that afterwards you will be able also to contribute to what I have said so that I also may learn from what you are thinking and doing. But let us begin with asking, what is it that makes church? What is it that makes the church? Many different answers have been given to this question. My own sense is that it is the receiving and the passing on and the re-receiving and the passing on again, that process of the apostolic teaching that makes the church. This is why I had chosen the first chapter of the first letter of St. John this morning for our Bible reading. Because that tells you how this apostolic testimony is heard, is owned, and is passed on. This process must continue without interruption. Everything in our churches must be organized in such a way that the apostolic preaching of the cross can continue, indeed of the resurrection, of Pentecost. And as this apostolic teaching is passed on, received, passed on again across generations and across cultures, yes, it is only just Coke. I thought Paul might add some rum to it, but he hasn't done so. As this teaching is passed on and received, of course, different people in different cultures at different times discover things new and old in it. That is what the Lord Jesus said, didn't he? That when he said how blessed the scribe was who brought out of the treasure things new and old. And that is what happens when there is an authentic transmission of what the apostles have given to us. Just to take an example, many oppressed people, when they read the Bible for themselves, discover that they have a particular affinity with the story of the Exodus, an oppressed and enslaved people being freed by God's mighty hand and God's purposes fulfilled among them. Well, you would expect that, wouldn't you? Different people notice different things. Women read the Bible in a way different from how men read it. That is as it should be. Elements that are neglected in the Bible are brought to our attention by others. And similarly, we can bring to people's attention what we have noticed. Also, and I think we have to be quite clear here, there has to be a constant relating of this apostolic teaching, of this apostolic tradition, to new knowledge. There is such a thing as new knowledge. We live in a world that is exploding with new knowledge. For many years, I don't know if it was a privilege or a trial. I was the chair of the Ethics and Law Committee of the Human Fertilization and Embryology Authority in Britain. Vast learning curve for me. And when I was leaving, the government minister giving me my gong, you know, saying thank you, she said, "Well, Bishop, you've never been comfortable here, have you?" And I said, "No, but I didn't come here to be comfortable. I came here to fulfill a responsibility." However, the point is this, that during that time, I realized how much more we know about the human embryo than even our parents did, even 50 years ago, even 30 years ago. And that knowledge is increasing constantly. But the question was for me then, and is for us today, how do we relate what the gospel teaches about the dignity of the human person with this new knowledge? What are the challenges? And where do we have to say no to people who want to use the new knowledge in ways that are contrary to God's purposes? So there has to be a constant bringing of this apostolic teaching into a relationship with new knowledge. And the apostolic teaching, enables us to appreciate what is new as well as what is old. When I say I'm tired of being a conservative, it's because the general idea is that conservatives are head in the sand, stick in the mud, reactionaries. But this is not the case. There has to be, as this apostolic teaching comes into contact with new knowledge, we need a proper view of development. And what is principled in this bringing apostolic teaching into a relationship with new knowledge? And what is unprincipled? Well, John Henry Newman, whom I suppose we must call blessed now, he is a blessing in many ways to Anglicans as well as other Christians. He pointed out how this development of our thinking about what is new can be principled. For instance, it must have, he said, a conservative action on the past. That is to say, it is not right just to throw everything out, the baby with the bathwater, because we've got some new things. It must conserve the gospel. So I'll come back to that in a moment. Nothing that we can do must affect the power of the gospel to change lives. As David was saying just now, that's the mission statement, isn't it, at St. George's. There must be continuity of principles. And then there must be a way of relating to change that is faithful to the apostolic teaching itself. Now, all of these things are necessary to say. But when a question arises, as it has arisen for us in a very sharp way in the Anglican Communion, what is the apostolic teaching in respect of this or that matter? How do we decide? And the Anglican way has always been to say that when there is a dispute about the nature of the apostolic teaching, then that dispute must be settled by an appeal to the scriptures. We could put it another way. The scriptures are the norm by which we determine what is apostolic in one context or another. Now, this is, of course, the reason why Anglicans have always had a love of the scriptures and have always studied the scriptures with great care. You study something that is important, not something that is unimportant. And I would hope that in these new movements that we are experiencing in the Anglican world, that the study of the scriptures will be absolutely central to what we do. Three things about ourselves and the Bible that are important, I feel. One, when we read the Bible, of course, we look at what is behind the text when we study the Bible. What is behind the text? How the text came to be what it is. How was it put together? What were the stories about the patriarchs and the prophets and the kings that were brought together in the writing of one book of the Bible or another? What were the reasons that made the authors write as they did? What were their intentions and purposes as far as we can discover them? All of this is very important in our understanding of the Bible. What is behind the text? Then secondly, what is in the text? That means a very careful study of the language, the literary character, the situations that a particular text is addressing. No exegete of the Bible can succeed without this careful attention to the text itself. We have just produced a DVD, I don't know if there's a copy here, but Greg, you had one, didn't you? In which we've tried to show to people who are not Christians, actually it was produced mainly for a Muslim audience, something about the integrity of the text of the Bible. Behind the text, what is in the text, and then of course, what is in front of the text. How the Bible relates to the different situations, the different cultures, the different contexts in which we all live. That is how the Bible is to be used in the church, if you want to put it like that. So the Bible is the norm of the apostolic teaching. One matter that I have begun to notice fairly recently is that if you think of the Christian churches, there seems to me to be a divide between those churches that emphasize the sacred deposit, the Bible, and those that emphasize the sacred ministry. So some Christians will claim that it is the apostolic ministry that guarantees the health of the apostolic teaching in the church. Others will say, no, it's the sacred deposit. Now, it has been the virtue of Anglicanism, and Anglicanism does have some virtues, although sometimes they're difficult to spot in our present situation. But one of the great virtues has been that Anglicanism has tried to hold these two aspects together. A sacred deposit that is sustained and nurtured and proclaimed by an apostolic ministry. This apostolic ministry needs, therefore, to remain faithful to the sacred deposit. And it has a particular role in the explaining and the living and the sharing of that sacred deposit. It does have that role. You may want to comment on this later on. The Bible, in relation to cultures and contexts, what is in front of the Bible? Well, friend of mine who's a professor at Yale, Professor Lamine Sane, many of you will have heard of him or even heard him speak, who's a convert, Muslim, a convert to Christian faith from Islam, originally from West Africa, uses the term translatability. His initial work actually had been about the impact of the translation of the Bible into various African languages and how those missionaries who had translated the Bible into various African languages could not have known the impact that the Bible would make on different cultures. Well, it has ever been so, hasn't it? The Bible's impact on culture is something that is dramatic and unpredictable. And that's also true, of course, of human lives, generally. But translatability, Lamine Sane uses this word to mean more than just Bible translation. He claims that the gospel is inherently translatable. You see, Jesus spoke Aramaic, but the New Testament is written in Greek. And it was not retranslated back into Aramaic, which by then was being called Syriac, until, 100 years after. So that process has gone on, of course, and it continues to go on. The Bible continues to be translated into this language or that so that people can read it in their own language. And as you know, reading the Bible in your own language is quite different from reading it in another one. Quite different. But if you don't know, let me assure you that it is. So the gospel is inherently translatable, and in this, of course, Christian faith and the gospel differs from, let us say, Islam. I'm talking more about Islam, God willing, tomorrow evening. But Islam, also like Christianity, is a worldwide faith. It exists in every part of the world now. And wherever it goes, it does adjust, mutatis mutandis, to the culture and the context in which it finds itself. So Indonesian Islam, for example, is not at all like Arab Islam. It's quite different, and you can see and the differences. However, there is a kind of residual Arabicness about Islam that can never be lost. The Quran has to be in Arabic. The translations are there to help people, but they're not the Quran. The call to prayer has to be in Arabic. After Kemal Atatürk, they tried it in Turkish, in Turkey for a while, but the attempt failed. The salat, the ritual prayer, has to be offered in Arabic, wherever you are or from whatever country. So in this, Islam is quite different from this inherent translatability of the gospel. And that process has continued, as I say, from the very beginning. Pope Benedict has been mentioned already. I think it was by Bishop Don. One of the highest compliments I've ever been offered is when I was talking to His Holiness, and he said, you are the bishop who knows some Catholic theology. And of course, I was taken by surprise, and as is so often the case, you make an inappropriate reply. And I said to him, not as much as Your Holiness. So there you are. However, Pope Benedict has pointed out what he calls the providential relationship between the Christian faith and the Hellenistic world and Hellenistic culture. And it is true that what he calls purified Hellenism, has provided the Christian church with a vocabulary which it has used, for example, to articulate the historic creeds. However, I mean, I'm bound to say that the kind of weight that Pope Benedict places on Acts chapter 16, you know, the summons to Macedonia and the identification of the Christian faith with Europe, I don't think as an exegete that Acts 16 will take that weight, to be quite honest. I say that with fear and trembling, of course. Because I have great respect for him, both as an intellectual and as a man of the spirit. However, the point is that just as the encounter with Hellenism was taking place and was providential, there were many other such providential encounters taking place even then. I have for a very long time been a student of the story of the Christian faith in the Persian Empire, which was the other great superpower to Rome at the time. And the story is remarkably similar. The same persecutions, the same accommodation, the same encounter with culture, even the lists of the martyrs, nearly as long as the Roman martyrologies. And the first nation to call itself Christian was Armenia, not noted for its Hellenism. And of course, the great empire, the great Christian empire at the time of the rise of Islam was Ethiopia. Now, if you've experienced Ethiopian Christianity, it's very vigorous, but it's not Hellenistic. The Pope expresses his wish that what happened in the Christian encounter with Hellenism would happen today in relationship to culture. And that is the important point about the Regensburg address, by the way, not what caught the press's attention. We won't go into that, maybe tomorrow. The point is that this process of translation has been going on, and William Tyndale, when he translated the Bible into English, I was present with a Roman Catholic bishop in the diocese where Tyndale was strangled to death. The Roman Catholic Church has expressed its repentance for its role in Tyndale's imprisonment and execution, for which we are grateful. But the point about Tyndale's translation of the Bible is not only did it make the Bible for the first time really available to the English people, but it also in doing so created the English language as we know it. That's the point. It is impossible to think of a Herbert or a Donne or a Shakespeare or a Milton without a Tyndale. And that is what happens with gospel as translation, in the way in which Lamine Sane has used this word. The commitment of the Book of Common Prayer in its preface and the Articles of Religion to worship and teaching in a tongue that can be understood by the people provides the basis for this translatability in Anglican tradition. Of course, we can say that Anglicans and their record in this area has been patchy. Although we pay lip service to translation, in fact, we quite like to keep things as they are. This is why church planting is not just creating a congregation in a new place, but it is a grappling with culture, and it is creating a church that is appropriate for a particular place, a particular language, a particular people. Well, you know that if you've tried it, how that works. However, there is another matter. This is the light side, if you like. There is a darker side to this matter, which is that sometimes people can own the gospel in such a way that it excludes others. You know, if this particular group of people, ethnic or whatever, is Christian, then others cannot be. See, in Iran, for instance, Because for so long, the Christian communities have been the Assyrians and the Armenians and the Chaldeans, that the Persian-speaking Christians, until the revolution, it was very difficult to convince them that they could be Christian as well. Because the Christians were those others, weren't they? Praise the Lord, the Islamic revolution has changed the situation completely, and there are now hundreds of thousands of Persian-speaking Christians, both within and outside Iran. You see, that is how God's providence overrules. This would never have happened without the Islamic revolution, whatever we may think of it. So the gospel can be made captive to culture. And there is the temptation also to capitulate to culture. A very important book by the two American theologians, Ephraim Radner and Philip Turner, called The Fate of Communion. I don't know if you've read it. I hope, be seeing Ephraim when I go to Wycliffe on Monday, because he is there nowadays. But the point that they make is that there is something inherent in Anglicanism that makes for the possibility of capitulating to culture. And they say what has happened in the Episcopal Church in America is simply an illustration of an inherent weakness. Well, is it? And if it is, then we need to deal with it so that it does not happen again and again and again. As we recognize the diversity that there is already in the Anglican Communion, I will have been to 18 different countries this year. And of course, wherever you go, the Anglican Church is the same. But it's also different. And that is a matter generally for celebration. There is such a thing, of course, as a proper diversity. We are not seeking some kind of superimposed uniformity. But the question is how there is to be unity within that diversity. Or how is there going to be diversity within a unity? Depends on how you put it. That is the question. There are a number of things that have to be said. First of all, unity is a good thing. I'm certainly not against unity. And those people who have disturbed the unity of the Anglican Communion, they are not us. We have not disturbed, I hope. There is nobody here who wanted to disrupt the unity of the Anglican Communion. I certainly did not want to. But it has been imposed on us by people who have departed from the apostolic faith, from adherence to the scriptures, and from Anglican teaching as we had all received it. Unity needs to be worked at, and unity has to be principled. You will remember that at the Kiel Evangelical Anglican Congress, John Stott played a very major role in convincing Anglican evangelicals that they should stay within the Church of England and the Anglican Communion. And many of them, of course, heeded his advice against the call by Martin Lloyd-Jones for them to leave. Well, after the traumatic events that happened in the Anglican Communion, I asked John about this. I said, you asked us to stay because you said that the Church of England and the Anglican Communion was comprehensive. What do you say now? And he said, I have always believed in and taught a principled comprehensiveness. Principled comprehensiveness. That is to say, the unity must be one that is based on certain principles. If so, what are they? How can we have a proper unity in the faith, not just structural, not just institutional, but a living fellowship of prayer, of agreement in faith, of support for one another and mutual encouragement for one another in our mission and ministry? Well, there is a tradition about this which we should not ignore. I mean, we should not seek to invent new things just for the sake of it. William Reed Huntington, the great American Episcopalian theologian before his time in many ways, because he was interested in Christian unity, he realized that Anglicans had to say something about what sort of unity would be acceptable. And that is why he articulated those principles which came to be called the Chicago-Lambeth Quadrilateral. Now, you know what those four are: the ultimate and final authority of the Scriptures, the sacraments instituted by Christ himself, what we call the Catholic creeds, and of course a ministry that was apostolic and, as your canons put it, in historic succession. He said this was a basis for Anglicans approaching other Christians about unity in the faith and in the cause of the Church's mission. And this, it has to be said, this Chicago-Lambeth Quadrilateral has been hugely influential ecumenically. So many discussions about further Christian unity have taken place because of it. It has played a very important role in those discussions. But I think it is also important in Anglican self-understanding, in who we believe ourselves to be, not just in relationship to other Christians. However, good as it is, it has been shown not to be enough. So what else is there? In the last, century or so, let us say, attempts have been made to develop what are called Anglican instruments of unity. The Lambeth Conference was the first. The gathering of primates was next. Rather strange animal called the Anglican Consultative Council was another. And of course the office of the Archbishop of Canterbury was yet another. But even those who are in these instruments now say that they have failed. So the quadrilateral is not enough. The instruments have failed. What are we to do? What are we to do? Well, it seems to me that if we are going to be a worldwide fellowship of believers, as the Bible calls us to be, we need to be a fellowship of Christians of churches where we can gather together. See, gathering is very important. This is why your synod, Bishop, is so important. A synod does not mean a body that meets to transact business. It doesn't mean that. A synod means those people who have agreed to walk in the way of the Lord, in celebration, in prayer, in the observance of the sacraments, in Bible teaching, whatever it may be. Gathering is very important. And one of the problems since the crisis that has hit us has been a failure to gather people together. This was seen clearly when nearly a third of the bishops of the Anglican Communion did not come to the Lambeth Conference. That has never happened before in that way. A failure to gather. So new ways have to be found to gather. When I arrived at GAFCON in Jerusalem, I was only able to go to GAFCON for 3 days, and I was under strict security protection for reasons I don't want to go into now, which I was met at the airport by the Israeli security, who said, whenever you are out of your bedroom, Bishop, we will be within 6 feet of you. And they were absolutely, literally right about that. And I felt like a prisoner. However, my wife, Valerie, actually played a very leading role in GAFCON, a far more important role than I played. But when I arrived to address the conference, I discovered again what it was for Anglican Christians to come together under the gospel and under God's providence, afresh. People from different backgrounds, high church, low church, no church. No, not no church. Charismatic, evangelical, Anglo-Catholic, all happily worshiping together, teaching and being taught, eating with one. I mean, I wasn't allowed to eat with other people because the Israeli security always told me to sit at a table in a corner for my own safety. It was very frustrating. However, I could see other people were doing it, and that was great. That was great. Gathering is so important, but it's not enough. You also need deciding together. You see, a synod is not a synod until and unless it can make decisions together about what affects everyone. Of course, your synod will not tell you how to run your parishes. Well, you won't let them, will you? But if there is something that affects all the parishes, then, of course, the synod must have something to say. And this is true at every level of the church's life, that what affects everyone must be decided by everyone. No one can say for themselves, this only affects us. That has to be left to the discernment of the wider church. Of course, many things, most things, will only affect you, and other people should not interfere. But when the church discerns, gathered together, that something affects them all, then they must all decide. Gathering and deciding together. And then the question of discipline. Any church worth the name must be able effectively to exercise discipline. See, there was a great debate at the time of the Reformation about what role discipline should play in the church. Is discipline essential to the being of the church? And of course, the reformers, Martin Luther and others, were aware that the medieval church had created a kind of discipline that was also bondage. And they wanted to liberate people from that bondage, rightly, of course. But in the Anglican Reformation, particularly under the influence of Bishop Jewell, and in the teaching of the homilies, which remain a doctrinal standard for us, by the way, it was clear that discipline is essential not only for the good of the church, but for its very being. No church can continue to be church without discipline. And any attempt to make it so is doomed to failure. Gathering, deciding, discipline. That also, by the way, is the teaching in 1 John 1, which is, of course, why I chose that particular passage. What actually does that mean? What is the cash value of it in terms of worldwide Anglicanism, or even more locally? There are a number of things that I want to say, which are difficult to say, but I think they need to be said. First of all, the church has to be a confessing church. I use that word deliberately and advisedly. I'm not using the word confessional, because that can be understood to mean adhering to the sorts of confessions that the Presbyterians do, for example. Well, maybe Bishop Don can, because he's a moderator. But but that's quite different. Being a confessional church is one thing. Being a confessing church is something else. That is to say, the church declares itself to adhere to the gospel, to the apostolic teaching, to the historic creeds, to ways of gathering and deciding that have always been honored in the Christian church. You see, sometimes people think that Anglicans believe nothing. Sometimes they think Anglicans believe anything. I don't know which is worse. This cannot go on. We must be a properly confessing church. Secondly, we have to be a conciliar church. That is to say, our council should be such as can gather and teach authoritatively. One of the sadnesses about the Lambeth Conference, apart from the fact that a third of the bishops were not there, was that it was unable to teach. One of the things that the Lambeth Conferences have been doing in the last 150 years or so is to have been developing a body of teaching. Well, that's finished now. How are we going properly to be conciliar? This means that we have to find ways of bishops gathering. Owen Chadwick said on one occasion that wherever there are bishops, they find ways of gathering. But I think rightly, I mean, not for junkets, but because it is part of the office of being bishop to gather with others so that the apostolic faith can be taught. So conciliar certainly in that respect, but conciliar also in involving the rest of the church in the process of consulting and deciding. The account in Acts chapter 15 of the Council of Jerusalem is very instructive in this respect. The apostles and the elders with the whole church gather. The apostles have a particular role. The apostles and the elders actually write the letter that is sent to the churches. But it is the whole church that sends the letter. So, conciliarity must include bishops, clergy, faithful, but each exercising ministry in an appropriate way in the context of that gathering. The ministry of each is not the same as the ministry of another. Bishops have a particular role in guarding the faith. Clergy have a particular role as pastors and teachers. Lay people have an apostolate that is particularly theirs, and so on. And this leads to the third point, which is again actually a Presbyterian point. I mean, maybe I'm coming around to Bishop Don's way of thinking after all. that is, these, it's the only moderator in a chasuble. He'll have the opportunity to get back at me, I'm sure. These councils have to be consistorial. You know that consistorial is a particularly Presbyterian word. Well, diocesan bishops in the Church of England have consistory courts. But I think the Presbyterian consistory court was for the purpose of ecclesiastical discipline. So that what we teach and what we decide sticks in the church. Now, a warning about institutions. I think we have to be very careful that we do not elevate institutions into something they can never be. This has been one of the besetting sins of Anglicanism in recent history, that institutions have been created and have been set above almost the gospel, it seems. Canon law has become more important than the Bible, it seems. In fact, it is not institutions that renew the church. It is movements of people. From the very beginning, after Constantine, when the church began to grow fat and wealthy and privileged, there were those peoples who moved out into the desert, weren't there? And what a movement that began in the monasteries of Egypt and of Syria. Pope Benedict, in his exaltation of European Christianity, in his charity, also notes that there were some significant developments in the East. Well, monasticism was one of them. and what an amazing development that was. But the evangelical revival produced the missionary societies. When the CMS was formed, it took the Archbishop of Canterbury 2 years even to reply to the letter that the leaders of CMS had sent to him asking for his blessing on what they were doing. Well, I'm very happy that they did not stop just because he had not replied. You see, the work of the gospel cannot wait on institutional and bureaucratic propriety. It has to go forward. What is the movement that God is calling us to be part of at this time for Anglicans? The renewal of Anglican churches, of Anglican provinces, of Anglican people will not take place because we have created institutions, however good they may be. We need to do that. But that is not the way of renewal. The way of renewal is, though seemingly spontaneous, but nevertheless we believe providential movements that are brought about by the work of the Holy Spirit. Without that, we can plant churches, we can have synods, we can create institutions, we can write canon law, but nothing will be of any avail. Brothers and sisters, what we need is spiritual renewal, a new faithfulness to the gospel of Jesus Christ, not only for ourselves, but a commitment to take that gospel to the neediest people and the neediest parts of the world. This will be costly for us, is costly for us already. One of the fears that I have is that we are being boxed into a corner that will make us look like a sect. This must be resisted in every way possible. The Church of God cannot be boxed in like that. And it is only through these movements of spiritual renewal and of mission that we will show ourselves genuinely to be church and not just people with some special interests. Not a club, but a church. Clubs have their place. Bureaucracies have their place, institutions theirs. But if this is about anything, This is a call to mission. And I am so delighted that the movements of Orthodox people in so many parts of the Anglican Communion have emphasized mission as a priority. I'm sure that you do here in Canada, and the commitment to plant churches, to bring people to faith, to nurture people in the faith, that is what it is all about. Others may have property, they may have money, but if they do not have the gospel, they will not be able to make new Christians. They will not be able to grow Christians in the faith. They will not be able to bring about new communities of faith. In fact, we may find that even the old ones begin to disappear. That's the challenge. I am sure that you are fully aware of the challenge and indeed are meeting the challenge the way that God wants you to. And I'm sure also that God will give you those resources that you need. All I say is, don't look inwards, look outwards. Thank you very much indeed.